This is Culturetopia, a look back at the week's best arts reporting from National Public Radio. I'm Felix Contreras, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk and blogger for A Blog Supreme. Every week, we bring you the best cultural coverage from books and music to movies, television, and everything in between. You can find links to all the stories we feature each week at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, writer Neil Gaiman pens a final love letter to Batman. Aravind Adiga discusses his latest collection of stories set in a town in southern India. And headbanging rocker Andrew W.K. shares one of his favorite pieces of music, and it's not what you might think. But first, Harry Potter. Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince opened in theaters this last Wednesday. Film critic Kenneth Turan says the latest Potter movie, the sixth in the series, will make fans happy.
The Half-Blood Prince begins with the dread Death Eaters on the march, threatening Hogwarts and all that it stands for. But don't let that fool you. The new Harry Potter film is as comfortable and reliable as an old shoe.
You are, of course, wondering why I brought you here tonight.
Actually, sir, after all these years, I'll just sort of go with it.
Take my arm.
The sixth picture in the series, Half-Blood Prince understands that it's not chills or suspense audiences are asking for here, but respectful familiarity. The Potter films are the modern exemplars of establishment movie making. We look to them for a level of craft, consistency, and most of all, fidelity to the originals. All of which we get. It's the phenomenal success of the books that's made all this possible. They've created an audience that has invested so much emotion, not to mention time, in the Potter saga that skipping a movie episode is out of the question. That's a kind of brand loyalty that's all but gone out of style. That investment of time also means that we've been watching the film's youthful principals, Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, and Emma Watson, grow up on screen since 2001. They've become as familiar as family members, and Half-Blood Prince trades on that to keep us involved when an emphasis on the agonies of teenage romance slows things down.
What you see before you is a curious little potion. It does cause powerful infatuation or obsession.
I'm in love with her!
All right, fine, you're in love with her. Have you ever actually met her?
Can you introduce me?
Fortunately, there's more to Half-Blood Prince than youthful heartache. Evildoers scheme dark schemes, and Harry has serious tasks of his own to attend to. Hearts Across America will beat faster when Michael Gambon's Dumbledore says to Harry, as only he can, "Once again, I must ask too much of you."
There's a new graphic novel from DC Comics, and it's part coda, part love letter, and a summation of Batman's raison d'etre, says writer Neil Gaiman. Gaiman's take on the Batman mystique, Whatever Happened to the Caped Crusader, takes readers inside a memorial service for Batman. Gaiman also penned the Sandman series as well as the children's book Coraline. He joined Neil Conan on Talk of the Nation to discuss the Batman project.
In many ways, I did Whatever Happened to the Caped Crusader so that I didn't have to choose. Mm-hmm. I got to try and put all of them in there, even the Adam West one. The first one is always probably the most impressive. And obviously, I'm of a generation where that was the TV show.
The TV show is with the Adam West you're talking about.
The original Adam West TV show.
Biff, Pam, Pow.
Absolutely. And of course, what was great about that, though, was I was 6-7 years old when it came to England. So I didn't regard it in any way as camp or funny. I used to worry. They'd do those cliffhanger endings at the end of everything, and there would be Batman and Robin tied to a balloon being sent off into the air to die a horrible death with a cackling Joker or grinning Penguin. And I would worry for a week until the next episode came on and they got out.
They eventually went to 2 episodes a week, so you were doubly troubled.
Exactly. Yeah. It was very worrying.
What you're talking about, bringing all of those characters back in this one two-part comic book, that involves some interesting writing. You have to work very closely with your artist, for one thing.
I was incredibly lucky. I don't think I could have done this thing. And Whatever Happened to the Caped Crusader is essentially a two-part Batman story. I was asked if I'd like to write something that would be a two-part story that could be the last episode of Batman Comics and then the last episode of Detective Comics, mm-hmm. where Batman started all those years ago.
Detective. DC Comics is called Detective Comics because it's DC Detective Comics.
Exactly. And in Detective Comics number 27, back in 1939, Batman made his first appearance. So it was very fitting that the last Batman story in Detective got to be
mm-hmm.
But it was the point where they told me that I could have Andy Kubert as my artist that I got really excited and thought, okay, I could probably do this completely mad thing where I get to talk about every single aspect of Batman or all the ones I've ever cared about and even some of the ones that I didn't.
I asked this question to the man who did so much with the Sandman. Is Batman the most interesting character in comics?
I've never thought of any character as being the most interesting character in comics. I don't think there is a the most interesting character in comics, because the truth is characters are as good as you write them. Hmm. And the glory of great characters and the glory of great writers and creators is that point where you put a wonderful creator on a second, third, fourth, or even a fifth string character, and suddenly you have Frank Miller doing Daredevil, and everybody going, oh, Daredevil was such a great character. Or Alan Moore doing Swamp Thing, who was just considered a joke. I think what you get in that mainstream comics thing is you get out of it what the creator is willing to put into it. The joy of Batman, I think, is that he is A, incredibly old now. He's been around since our grandparents and our great-grandparents' days. And that allows you to have an awful lot of history to play with. On the other hand, I think that he became the archetype of all of the vengeful Avengers of the night. But I do think the problem that you can get in with Batman in that kind of situation is you can look at it and go, well, every story has been told. They have all been done before, which was why I started. I think one of the things that attracted me to it was just the idea of, okay, tell the last Batman story. What would the last Batman story be?
Now, last week, Minnesota's junior senator, Al Franken, stumped Judge Sonia Sotomayor at her Senate confirmation hearing. Now, both are fans of Perry Mason, and Franken asked the Supreme Court nominee to name the only case Perry Mason lost, and she couldn't. So what was that one case that Perry Mason lost? There's a little conflicting information. From the web, we hear it was this one, the case of the deadly verdict.
We, the jury, in the above-entitled cause, fix the punishment as death for the crime of murder as charged in the indictment dated August 24th.
You wish to have the jury polled, Mr. Mason?
No, Your Honor. That won't be necessary.
To get to the bottom of it, Robert Siegel spoke to Emmy Award-winning actress Barbara Hale, who played Perry Mason's incredibly capable assistant all those years, Della Street.
How many cases did Perry Mason lose?
Robert, of course only one. You must realize that Perry never lost cases. And with the one that he lost, it was claimed a mistrial. As far as the show was concerned, he never lost a case.
Uh-huh.
Of course, you don't realize the other cases that were tried during the week when we weren't on television.
I see. So there were really umpteen thousands of cases that we just never saw.
That's right.
Uh-huh. But I've read on a website called the Perry Mason TV Show Book that in the case of the witless witness, that begins with a judgment being handed down against Perry. Doesn't count?
Oh, no.
See,
those things were claimed mistrials.
I see. Whenever Perry Mason lost, it was eventually a mistrial.
Oh, absolutely.
In the case of the terrified typist, a jury returns, I'm reading this from the website, returns a guilty verdict against Perry's client, but Perry is still able to clear the defendant. I see. So he always...
Oh, absolutely.
He always would win in the end.
There was only one Perry Mason. You know, Robert, we did, about 330 shows. And Believe me, my dear, it's very hard to think back and try to remember those things.
Yes. You and your colleagues provided a great many of us with a great many memorable moments, evidently including a very likely member of the Supreme Court.
That's very sweet, Robert. Thank you.
Well, it's our pleasure. And Barbara Hell, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, you're just lovely. It was grand talking to you.
Barbara Hell, who played the character Della Street in all those episodes of Perry Mason, in only one of which, she says, he lost the case.
Aravind Adiga won the prestigious Booker Prize in the United Kingdom with his debut novel, The White Tiger. His follow-up is a series of stories all set in Kittur, a seaside town in southern India of about 100,000 people. Kittur seems to snooze, suspended in time between 1984 and 1991, between the time Indira Gandhi was assassinated and then her son and successor, Rajiv. Aravind Adiga, who has also been a correspondent for Time magazine, talked to Scott Simon this last weekend.
When I was a boy in a town called Mangalore in the south of India, which forms the basis for this fictional town, Kittur, there was one uncle, and only one, who was not very welcome in my house. And this man, I later discovered, had been a member of a radical communist faction. India had, like China, has a long history of communism, but in India the communists never won, the radical communists. They were defeated because India has a liberal parliamentary system which resisted communism. I wanted to do a story about a communist and the tensions he would face in India because this uncle of mine, who was a radical communist, also wanted to be a writer. I later did some work and found out something about him. He wanted to be a writer and a communist, and he had always felt these two impulses clashed because being a communist, being an idealist, asks you to see the best in human beings, and being a writer often asks you to see the worst in them. But this final story of the idealistic communist who has a crisis late in his life is also the story of the India of the 1980s, which where the old socialist system was finally cracking up and something new, which is the new capitalist India, was on its way.
I hope this didn't sound patronizing, but for those of us who love India, that's part of its appeal. Although I must say, well, as my wife, who's French, will put it, she says that France is the best place in the world to be a communist because you can be a communist and not actually have to live under it.
Well, to some extent that's true of India as well. We have various shades of communism in India. There are the communists who have learned to work with the parliamentary system and are in power in places, have worked through elections. And then there are those communists who reject parliamentary democracy entirely. But one of the great things about India historically is that it has been a place where people who are upset with the system have had a chance to speak out, because it has been a liberal democracy and it's given room for dissent. The thing about the books I write, The White Tiger or this book, Between the Assassinations, is I don't think they could get published in any of the countries around India, because those are not free countries. India is a liberal country which allows room for dissent, which is why it thrives. And this is something I think outsiders miss. A lot of countries in the world from Asia you never hear about, or you tend to get rosy pictures, and then one day you hear the country has collapsed in civil war and you wonder how this happens. A country from which you're constantly getting news, and even if that news is not always great, is a free country, and a country that will prosper and survive and is fundamentally a stronger country. And that's India's story.
You can hear the rest of that interview at our website, npr.org/culturetopia. Now, from India, we go to Argentina. NPR's own Bob Mondello is in Buenos Aires for the summer, and he found that billboards have gone up with the familiar red, white, and blue Pepsi logo. But instead of Pepsi, it says Pexi. That's P-E-C-S-I. And on TV, commercials explain what's going on.
El 24,333% de los argentinos no dice Pepsi, dice Pexi. Ellos también quieren ahorrar. Por eso ahora tienen Pexi.
Bob Mondello has the rest of the story.
It's basically, if you can't beat them, join them. Pepsi has decided that since people in Buenos Aires have been ordering Pepsis at refreshment stands for decades, there's no real point in fighting them. On the billboards under the word Pepsi are Spanish words that mean freedom of expression or freedom of pronunciation. That's a freedom that folks in Buenos Aires take seriously.
Porteños, as they're known, have been pronouncing things unlike the rest of the world for ages, even the rest of the Spanish-speaking world. For instance, Ys and double Ls, pronounced Y in Spanish from Spain to Mexico, are here pronounced Sh. My last name, for instance, if I don't tell someone to pronounce it Mondello, is apt to come out Mondesho. So Pepsi it has been, and now Pepsi's saying, hey, call us anything you like, just drink it. Actually, Coke has a product that could have tried this same campaign. Here, when people say Sprite, they drop both the S sound at the beginning of the word and the T sound at the end and say Pry. There's also the fact that Spanish is a consistent language in terms of pronunciation, so folks here, having learned that the words like and strike have silent E's at the end, mostly assume that the famous shoe company is called Nike. Perfectly logical. If you say you want some Nikes, people send you to a shoe store. Pepsi, as always, will get you a bubbly beverage, though personally, I prefer Pry. In Buenos Aires, I'm Bob Mondesho.
Si tomas Pepsi, ahorras. Si tomas Pepsi, también.
Gracias, Roberto. Headbanging rocker Andrew W.K., whose songs include Party Hard, It's Time to Party, and Party Till You Puke, thinks the music of Johann Sebastian Bach stands among humankind's greatest accomplishments. As part of All Things Considered's You Must Hear This series, Andrew W.K. talks about one of his favorite pieces of music.
I've played piano since I was 4 years old, and I've always loved songs by Johann Sebastian Bach. For me, Bach's music is not only as good as music gets, it's as good as it gets, period. As good as existence, reality, life, and the world. The Fifth Brandenburg Concerto, specifically the first movement, Allegro, has all the joy, beauty, and exhilarating quality of human life at its best. The energy and exuberance in the melody and the attitude of the rhythm are as powerful to me as any rock and roll song, as energizing as any techno dance music, as driving and thrilling as any punk or heavy metal. There's even a harpsichord solo which has all the thrills, theatrics, and drama of a massive electric guitar shred fest. I like to imagine that the feelings Bach was trying to manifest were the equivalent feelings to what a hard rock band is trying to create. It's just pure joy, a total rush of energy, without ideas, concepts, or even specific emotions to stand in the way. It's everything and nothing and a mystery and a revelation all at once. The Fifth Brandenburg Concerto reminds me what really matters in music is the sensation of hearing it, feeling it, and it inspires me to continue to strive to create the strongest sensations I can using the methods and tools I have access to. I hope listening to this piece gives you a strong sensation about being alive and that you take those feelings and do something wonderful.
Party on, Andrew W.K. Nice one. That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Felix Contreras. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.